Lynn, why don't you go ahead now and give an overview of what you'll be presenting later on.
Thank you, Steve. Certainly, the performance of audits has added to the credibility of the information coming out. The auditing profession did seem to have hit a low point coming out of the corporate scandals of the Enrons and WorldComs, Adelphias of the world, if you will, and seemed to be making some progress coming out of that and with the establishment of the PCAOB to improve their audit quality, and I think the board deserves some credit with respect to their inspections in that regards. But in recent years, it seems that instead of moving forward, the profession seems to be moving backwards in a number of areas. We see them. We see the type of things that Barbara talked about in terms of lack of red flags, perhaps lack of credible reports on controls. We see the firms once again growing their consulting practices all over again, and we've seen in the past how when that happens, the tail seems to become the dog in terms of driving the mentality within the profession. And there's three of us around the table here, and Jürger, Damon, and myself, who spent over a year working on the U.S. Treasury Committee on report on the auditing profession, which included a number of hearings, public hearings, quite a substantial public comment period, public comment, a couple of exposure drafts, and it included a wide variety of people on that board, investors, people from the firms, representatives from the business community, regulators, et cetera. And it's now been 2.5 years since that report came out. Some of their recommendations, such as improvements to the communication between the auditors and investors, were not necessarily new. Those same type of recommendations were made back in the 70s and unfortunately weren't acted upon. And if they had been acted upon in a timely manner, and perhaps if some of the recommendations in the Treasury Committee had report had been in place prior to when we went into this crisis, perhaps investors, and hopefully investors, would have gotten red flags that they could have acted upon. And clearly, the markets are only efficient and can only be efficient if they get adequate information. As we've seen in recent years, they haven't gotten the information, and as a result, the markets have been woefully inadequate. Our own fund went from our members in our fund, about 500,000 people in Colorado, about 15% of the population, watched as their investment accounts went from an aggregate of about $44 billion down to about $26 billion. During this crisis, which had significant impact on them as well as our taxpayers. So it is a very significant issue. At the same time, many people watched as their 401ks of Vanguard or Fidelity or whatever go through exactly the same type of crisis. So we do think in our subcommittee, and there's a memo that we've prepared that's in your materials that give you greater detail, that it is time to finally act upon all those recommendations of the Treasury Committee report. This was an esteemed group of people led by former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt and former SEC Chief Accountant Don Nicolaisen. but some of those recommendations included in the area of transparency and governance, which we've all embraced for public companies around the globe. We've embraced for greater transparency in government agencies as well. The one place that we don't seem to be able to get it is in these large accounting firms. And we've seen the benefits of it in the operations and efficiency of other organizations, and one has to ask, why is it that this one group seems to be isolated from the benefits of that other organizations have seen? So certainly it's time for them to become much more transparent in terms of their financials, in terms of their governance. It's time for, as Dan Gelser has most appropriately called for, greater transparency at the PCAOB with respect to the investigations in that entire process, taking it back to what the SEC adopted, quite frankly, Chairman Shapiro, while you were there as a commissioner when the commission voted to make public all the 102E proceedings. And as I recall, briefing with you on that, you're a very positive supporter of that. There's also the issue with the increasing slide back into the consulting with respect to the independence of the audit firms. And the coziness of these firms, we've seen in a number of these cases, the audit firm had been with that company for decades. GAO report has also pointed out that that relationship has gone on for decades at other organizations. And in light of some of the situations we've seen reported in the press, it just raises the question as to whether still in the mind of the auditor, keeping those audit fees were more important than getting the right answer out, something we also saw with respect to the credit rating agency. So it's not something that just afflicted the auditors. But as we made changes with the credit rating agencies, it seems that it's time to make change and a fundamental change. We discussed this during the course of the ACAP report, the Treasury Committee. In fact, Paul Volcker was a very strong proponent of doing and acting on something like this. The chairs had chosen, after discussions with the firms, not to act on that. But I think it is now time to act on that. I think it's time to revisit the whole issue of mandatory rotation. And I think using a reasonable period for rotation, the time for that is past due now. And that was very key to some members on our subcommittee. Global audit quality, you've mentioned the problems with the Chinese audits. I think Chairman Doty is absolutely direct on target with that. Business has become much more global. If you look at the financial reports of companies such as IBM, Coca-Cola, and General Electric, the majority of their operations and their revenues come from outside the U.S. Those audits of those numbers are conducted by firms, affiliates outside the U.S. There are separate legal entities from the firm here. Yet over the years as that globalization has occurred, we have not changed fundamentally how we supervise and oversee those portion of the audits. And for many years, the firms have relied upon credentialing, where essentially if you had an affiliate and the partner was credentialed over in his own country, they pretty much went and did that portion of the audit without the type of supervision that you'd see being conducted here in the U.S. on the U.S. portion of the audit. I think it's time to revisit credentialing. I think it's time to revisit the supervision and how that is done. We've certainly seen problems with that with respect to Chinese audits, and I think it's past due time to revisit in its totality here and reconsider those standards. Chairman Shapiro, in her opening remarks, noted that perhaps it's time to redo standards. I think this is one standard that it's more than past due time to reconsider and change.
Lynn, I'm going to have to cut you off because I want to watch the clock very carefully, and we got your full presentation a little bit
later.
That's
fine, Steve.
And I know Damon, you know, can't understand why we don't preempt the White House and the Hill, but since clearly we don't in your mind, why don't you take your three minutes or so, and then we'll excuse you.
Well, Steve, thank you. I was going to say something to the effect of, you know, there are very few powers on this earth that would take me away from this committee, but you named two of them. I hope it will hearten folks around the table that one of the things that I'm doing on the Hill, it's testifying with respect to changes and proposed changes to Dodd-Frank, some of which I think go right to the issues we're discussing here today. Trying to be very brief here. And first, thank you for giving me the chance to speak a little bit out of turn. As I said before, I'm Damon Silvers. I'm the policy director of the AFL-CIO. I am here because of the interaction between our capital markets, our system of public accounting and public auditing, and the retirement security of working Americans. I think it's fair to say that we are our country is in a profound long-term retirement security crisis. The problems we've had in our financial markets over the last decade or more, repeated bubbles, repeated sort of crises in governance, disclosure, enforcement, regulation, are not the cause of our retirement security crisis, but they've exacerbated it profoundly. And we've heard, I think, from a number of other people in this room about the specific numbers at specific plans in terms of losses. I think that's people in this room, Chairman Shapiro, Chairman Doty, you all are in the position of having, for different reasons and in different ways, having to rebuild and restore both the strength and the public confidence in our financial regulatory institutions. And it's a great honor to be here with you because of the work. I know that, Jim, you're just beginning, and we've talked about it, and I have great confidence in where you're taking the board, and the great work, Mary, that you have done. But these are profound challenges. This meeting today, you've heard, I think, the presentations from my colleagues on, I think, these two very sort of overarching issues for this group and for the PCAOB. The question of both understanding and there being some accountability for the events of the last several years in the financial markets. And I think it's important to emphasize those events are continuing. This is not the matter that is over. It is as present as this week's headlines about irregularities in the mortgage markets, all of which have implications for the work of this board. This question of accountability, one, and the question, two, of the set of issues around the current present performance and future of the auditing profession that Lynn alluded to. Now, I just want to say before I have to leave that I'm extremely impressed and supportive of both the presentations that you'll see later in detail that you just heard summarized. And I want to say a word or two about this issue of understanding and accounting for, in a sense, the financial crisis and the role of the audit process and of public company auditors in respect to that crisis. The PCAOB, despite being in a very awkward position as a result of the Supreme Court litigation, is one of the very few institutions, other than those that were specifically ordered to do so, like the FCIC, one of the very few institutions in our government, or around our government, that has tried to do some kind of inquiry and report on the what happened in relation to its obligations in the financial crisis. But I think, and so the board, the staff deserve a lot of credit, but I think fundamentally the question that got asked got it backwards. The key issue is not the impact of the crisis on audits, although that's not a non-issue. The real issue is the question of the impact of the audits on the crisis. And there's a profound conundrum, and I'm going to quote to you from a little piece of the presentation you're going to hear. The Center for Audit Quality, which I respect greatly, many friends who work there and are involved in that body, said that, "We believe that auditors generally carried out their role effectively during the crisis and appropriately reached audit opinions within the context of the applicable accounting and auditing frameworks." I don't have enough information to judge whether that statement is true or not, but it seems to me it's almost equally disturbing if it's true than if it's false. Right? Because the question is, how could we possibly say that we have an adequate auditing framework if that outcome could occur? And so I think that question is the question that the PCAOB really needs to dig into and dig into deeply. And I think there are a couple of also further questions. I'll note that some of you may know this. I serve on the vice chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP. That body is issuing its final report today, and we go out of business, leaving me more time for the PCAOB and other things. But in the context of that work, it's become apparent to me, and I've raised this issue repeatedly here at the SAG, that they're just basic unanswered questions, such as, I'll just mention two of them. What were auditors supposed to have done around the question of going concern during the financial crisis? And in particular, what were they supposed to have done around firms who would have had a going concern problem but for government guarantees, particularly implicit ones? I mean, I think we know something about the GSEs, for example, but what about Citigroup and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs? Secondly, and I've alluded to this earlier, there are these continuing and profound issues about the valuation, accounting, and auditing of mortgage-related assets. Our oversight panel could not divine what an appropriate valuation was of troubled assets more than a year into the TARP program because the financial accounting for those assets was so opaque, and auditors signed off on all those statements. This is in our August 2009 oversight report. That problem seems pretty significant, but it's not been compounded by, I think, all the issues associated with the mortgage processing irregularities that are on the front pages this week. These are enormous questions, and no one has answered them. The board will have before it, this afternoon. You all will have before it this afternoon, as a result of my colleagues' work, detailed presentations on these issues, and they completely reflect my views and concerns. And I'll finally say, and close, that as a result of the work of the Treasury Committee that Lynn talked about, there is a menu of suggestions for how to, at a minimal, what I think are sort of minimal levels, because they don't reflect the events of the last 36 months. A set of basic ideas for how to improve the independence and accountability and transparency of the public company audit process. Items like audit financial statements for four audit firms, potentially outside directors, auditor rotation, and the like. I can't resist, in the context of Jay Hansen's comment, that auditors don't hear from investors enough. That one thing that's been sitting in front of the PCAOB for a while that might help that is for an actual human being to sign the audit statement. Be easy, much easier for that person to hear from investors if investors who knew who that person was. And so with that, I'll close, and I thank you for the opportunity to say a word or two.
And now, Joe, we'll get on with our first presentation, which relates to possible revisions to the auditor's report and an examination of the role of the auditor in today's securities markets. The working group looking at these issues is led by Professor Joe Carcella and includes Brandon Becker, Norman Harrison, Pete Nakway, Gus Sauter, and Ann Yerger. And others participating with this group included Ann Simpson, Bonnie Hill, and Mike Head. And while Pete, Bonnie, and Mike could not be here, it's my understanding that their views and those of Eric Vinson are incorporated in Joe's presentation. So, Joe, take it away.
Thanks, Steve. And let me thank again the board for convening this group, and Chairman Shapiro and Jim and Mike and Brian. Brian, there's a seat over here if you want to. No? Okay. For being here. The involvement of the SEC, I think, sends a real important signal. One of the things we've done that we'll talk about is we actually did a survey to gather data on what investors value. So it's not just our opinion. So let me go ahead and hand out the actual survey so that when we get to that, watch me tripping, you'll have that in front of you. And then I think there probably is enough copies, if not for everybody in the room, close to everybody in the room. And then we also have a PDF of the question-by-question results, so you can have that in front of you as well. All right. So our charge, and Jim or Jay, if I am blocking you, just if you can't see, just let me know. To look at the auditor's report. And the we have a subgroup of the IAG. In addition to myself, Norman Harrison is going to be involved from Breeden in presenting, Gus Sauter from Vanguard, and Ann Yerger from the Council of Institutional Investors. In addition, Brandon Becker from TIAA CREF was involved in our subgroup, and Ann Simpson from CalPERS was involved in our subgroup, from the people who are here today and then some people who aren't here. The first known written U.S. corporate audit report was a report by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company in 1827, and it talks about essentially just an audit of receipts and disbursements and talks about the accounts being correct. So you can see we've gone a long way in the last 170 years or so. As the audit report has evolved over the years, the first audit report, as I said, simply stated the findings of an accounting examination. It's cash in, essentially cash out. In the early 1900s, audit reports were very detailed and descriptive, provided a comprehensive examination of what the auditors did. The audit report was seen as a certification as to the accuracy of the numbers. And there wasn't a standard audit report until 1917, when there was a Federal Reserve bulletin on the topic. Over the years, there's been a lot of interest in this topic. and different commissions that have examined the topic. So the Cohen Commission back in 1978 looked at this, recommended that the auditor's work should be clearly described and their findings should be clearly described without using technical terminology, describe the audit function unambiguously, state the limitations of the audit function, and use standardized alternative phrases rather than a single standard report form. More recently, the CFA Institute has done surveys similar to what we've done on what investors want. Based on the CFA survey, they want more specific information about how auditors reach their opinion, more information about key risk areas, about significant changes in those risk areas, and about areas that require judgment and involve uncertainty. Earlier today, we've heard from Barbara and Lynn and Damon about the ACAP committee. The ACAP committee made a number of recommendations. One would be to clarify the auditor's role and limitations in detecting fraud, consider mandating the partner's signature on the auditor's report, and consider making the report more descriptive. So let's look at the world in 1990 and the world today. Why did I pick 1990? The last time there were any degree of substantive change to the audit report, at least by the profession, was as part of the expectation gap standards. Okay, and so you go back and you read SAS 58 and SAS 59, you know, those fun pieces of literature, and that was really the most recent change, and I'll leave it to people who are more familiar with this in the audience as to whether that was significant change or not. It was a change, whether or not it was really substantive. It's debatable, but it was a change. So let's pick 1990 and let's pick today. And let's look at our world. Okay? And so I have technology products up there, and they've changed a lot, right? There are whole new industries that exist today that didn't exist 20 years ago. The accounting profession has changed. Arguably, the firm's organizational structure has changed more than their product. And countries have changed. The largest country in the world, at least in terms of land size, 20 years ago, has now been split into smaller pieces. So let's see how the product we care about, the auditor's report, has changed in the last 20 years. So what I have up here is an audit report. And you have these slides in front of you, so you probably can't read this, but you have the slides in front of you, issued in February of 1996 by the Ernst & Young on the B.F. Goodrich Company, okay? Audit reported issued by Ernst & Young on the B.F. Goodrich Company today, okay? Now, what I've highlighted here for you is the same company. So we've held the company constant. The only thing that's changed in 15 years is highlighted. So there's now a reference to the standards of you, the PCAOB, and there's a reference to the 404 audit. Those changes were mandated by the United States Congress. So short of changes mandated by the United States Congress, arguably we would have seen exactly the same audit report 15 years later. So I think it's reasonable to make a supposition, right? Given the lack of change in the product, customers, i.e. investors, because if investors aren't the customer, why do you exist, must love the product. Norman will provide empirical evidence on the truth of that supposition later. Okay, so when we came together as a group, again, the group is Brandon from TIAA Cref, me, Norman from Breeden, Mike Head from TD Ameritrade, Bonnie Hill, who's on a bunch of corporate audit committees, Icon Blue, Pete Natchway, who's the CFO at Lake Mason, Gus from Vanguard, Ann Simpson from CalPERS, Eric Vinson, who's a hedge fund manager at Osprey, and Ann Yerger at the council. We came together, and one of the decisions we made very early is we did not want this to be the opinion of however many people they are, six wise men and women. We wanted it to be more broadly than that. And we also wanted it to be driven not just by, quote-unquote, investor advocates, but by people who every day are buying and selling equity and debt securities, trillions of dollars of equity and debt securities. So we made an effort to reach out to investors. And we were fortunate, and we had some help from BlackRock, which is the largest money management firm in the United States. We also wanted this to be as mainline corporate America as possible, to insulate against any criticism that we were driven by special interests. And we also had good help from Capital Group. So let's think about what we have here. The largest money manager in the country, Vanguard, the largest mutual fund in the country, Capital Group, the third largest mutual fund in the country. I'll say more about that in a little while. We also developed, so the people on the subgroup, we put together the survey with a lot of involvement from the people on the subgroup. I asked those individuals to get 3 to 5 people inside their organizations who buy and sell daily to fill out the questionnaire. And then we also developed a mailing list of 300 large investment banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, mutual funds, pension funds, and endowments, and we mailed to them. So we have a mix of kind of a choice-based sample and a random sample, because we just wanted as much feedback as we could get. We had respondents included CEOs of some of these organizations, presidents, managing directors, CFOs, chief investment officers, equity analysts, portfolio managers, controllers, and credit analysts. So that's kind of a sense of who responded. The survey, as you can see, it's in front of you. We started off with just project background and instructions. We had some baseline information on the current use of the audit report and the value that users feel they get from the audit report and potential changes that they would like to see. Then we broke the actual body of the survey into 3 sections. One would be, what additional information, if any, do investors want about the audit process itself? What did the auditor do? We asked them if they wanted additional information about what the auditor found, and then we asked them if they wanted the form of the report itself, structure of the report, to change. And then we tried to gather basic demographic information on the employer and the title of the person. So the responses received, it's hard to get people's attention in today's world, but we got 73 respondents, and we did receive multiple responses from BlackRock, 7, and as I said, $3.6 trillion of assets under management, Vanguard, 6, and 1.4, Capital Group, TIAA, Kreft, Legg Mason, Breeding Capital. Just those groups alone represent more than $7 trillion of assets under management. And in addition, we had responses. This is just a sampling. Highbridge Capital Management, Pershing Square, Osprey, the Virginia Retirement System, the Florida State Board of Administration, CalPERS, and a number of others. So that's a little bit about how we went about this, how we gathered, what the survey looks like, what the respondents looks like. And Norman, who's in back of me, is going to take it into our next section.
After many years of public speaking in different contexts, never to follow the professor to a microphone, but I haven't learned that lesson. Am I off? Is that okay? Try this. Okay. The first set of questions we asked were designed to set some parameters. I think when you're surveying a population, in this case, population users of financial statements about possible changes to the audit format of the auditor's report, the first question you ought to ask is whether users are satisfied with the status quo. Does the current report give you sufficient information? Do you find it a valuable tool? So that's the first question we asked. And not surprisingly, perhaps, most of our respondents told us that they do not believe that the current format of the audit report provides valuable information to them in their work as investors. It's important to understand as you read these results. You have the detailed survey results in front of you, but for purposes of summarizing the responses, we have included or attributed percentages only to the population of the respondents who actually expressed the point of view. There are five potential responses to each question, as you see. You could strongly disagree, be neutral, express no view, or agree or strongly agree. So the percentages we show here are only for the portions of the respondents in each case who expressed an opinion. So here, for example, 45% of the respondents told us they believe that the survey doesn't, the current audit report does not provide valuable information to facilitate their understanding of the financial statements. It's important to understand, though, however, that only 68% of the people who responded to this question had an opinion one way or the other. The rest were neutral or hadn't reflected on the issue. So of those who had a view, well over two-thirds were of the view that the current format of the audit report is not helpful to them in their work. 73% told us they skimmed the report quickly. And I hear this all the time in my work and discussions with colleagues and discussions with clients and in former lives with colleagues in the investment industry. Many are of the view that even calling this four-paragraph letter a report is a bit of glorifies it beyond what it really is, that it's nothing more than a transmittal letter or a check of the box and doesn't provide really any insight to investors as to what they're going to find in the financial statements that follow. And we get a sense of that through some of the narrative commentary, which was very helpful. I think one of the very, very useful features of this survey that Joe principally designed is that it provided our respondents a chance to give us not only a graded answer to a question, but narrative input. A lot of the comments are very, very helpful and shed some further light on these issues. The comments here, in each case by a portfolio manager or an investment professional at a large institutional money manager, tell us what we all hear a lot, I think what I certainly do in my dealings with investment professionals, and that is the audit report really is nothing but boilerplate. It's canned language. I sometimes count the paragraphs. If it's the right number of paragraphs, I keep going. If I don't see the words going concern jumping off the page at me, then that's really all that it does, which from an investment professional standpoint very, very often means very little. It's a pass-fail model. It's binary, yes, no, and that's it. Interestingly, however, there is another category of respondents that had a somewhat different view. We received responses in some cases from individuals who sit on the audit committees of mutual funds. And in this case, you see a different point of view expressed. Audit committee members in general tended to take the view that, well, yes, the auditor's report is one of the tiles in this mosaic that we look at and consider when we're getting comfort with the disclosures that our fund is providing. And it's interesting that those who have more of an actual relationship with the auditor, people who are responsible for retaining and overseeing the work of and regularly interacting with the auditor, attached greater significance to the auditor's report than the investment professionals who are actually on the front lines using the financial statements as raw data for the analytical investment process. We may talk about this more later in the Q&A session. There are other areas in which there are somewhat significant disparities in responses to our survey between investment professionals, people who actually go to work each day, crunch numbers, make investment decisions, or recommend investment decisions to the investment committees of their funds on the one hand, and people like audit committee members who are more involved in oversight and governance functions. There are some interesting departures, disparities, and responses that we may take a minute to reflect on. Far and away, the area in which our respondents most overwhelmingly agreed that further disclosure or some form of disclosure in the audit report will be very helpful in the investment process, comes in the area of disclosures of risks, which again intuitively makes sense, because if you think about it, what all of us do who are in the investment business is we analyze financial information and assign, attribute risks to the quality of the reporting, to the projections, to management's own disclosures, to the models we build to assign a value to a company, projecting future results and choosing an appropriate discount rate, a range of discount rates to apply to those earnings to try to derive some sense of a current value to determine whether a stock we believe is perhaps undervalued in the market. All of those functions, those day-to-day investment functions, involve assigning, attributing levels of risk and factoring risk into the investment process, the analytical process behind investment decision-making. So here our respondents most overwhelmingly said, if the auditor's report in some manner provided a narrative description of those areas of disclosure, those areas in the financial statements where the auditor saw relatively greater levels of risk, we would find that type of disclosure to be important. We would also like to know, for those areas of greater risk in the presentation of financial results, what additional resources did the auditor apply? Was there an expansion in the scope of the audit, an assignment of specialist resources to the audit firm? What did the auditor do in response to perceived areas of relatively high risk or significant risk in the issuer's financial reports? The next question was a question of disclosure around the allocation of audit firm resources to different aspects of the audit. And we asked specifically whether investors would find it useful to know the number of hours and the allocation of hours spent by the audit team on certain categories of the financial statements or accounts. And for the most part, the answer here was no, not really. Some expressed a view that it would be interesting to know, that it would perhaps be beneficial in some respects. But I think the consensus of the responses here was that allocation of individuals and the tallying of hours spent on various elements of the financial disclosure doesn't necessarily correlate with those areas of greatest risk or substantive significance. The labor-intensive nature of an audit task is not necessarily correlated with risk. Another area, however, where there was significant agreement among our audit respondents was in the category of potential disclosure by the auditor of the materiality thresholds that the audit firm applied in its review of the financial statements. Again, 56% expressed a positive view here, but we received, other than a neutral response to this question, from 73% of the people who answered the question. So the 56% is actually a substantial majority of those who took a view one way or the other. There was a lot of discussion around this. I think this is an area where the narrative discussion will shed some further light on the issue. Interestingly, one of the participants, an investment professional from one of the mutual funds we surveyed, actually didn't take issue with the concept or the proposition that there should be more disclosure around the issue of materiality thresholds, both quantitative and qualitative, but rather than have it be a matter of disclosure on an audit-by-audit basis or a firm-by-firm basis, believe that it should be the subject of a more broad-based standard-setting initiative, perhaps by the SEC or the FASB. Next category in terms of overall sort of background presentation that we asked about was whether investors would find it useful to know the nature of, the extent of work performed by firms other than the audit firm signing the audit report. And again, here we had a fairly overwhelming response. It wasn't one of the questions where everyone had a view. 67% of the respondents said either yes or no to some degree, but of those that responded, 47 percentage points, or 70% of the total respondents to this question, said that they would find it useful to know of situations in which other audit firms, including non-U.S. member firms of the U.S. firm signing the opinion, were participants in the audit. I think the issue here is one of level of confidence in the overall audit process and at least wanting to know, again, from a risk measurement standpoint, evaluating risks associated with the audit, whether there was substantial participation by firms or affiliate of firms who are beyond the scope of PCAOB and SEC oversight. So those were the threshold questions. And again, just to summarize briefly, far and away the two areas in which our survey respondents told us they would find it extremely useful to have substantive narrative disclosure or discussion by the auditor pertains to the areas of risk, identification of areas of risk in the issuer's financial statements where the greatest levels of risk appear, and knowing something more about what the audit firm did to audit and test and evaluate those risks. And secondly, some definition around the both the qualitative and the quantitative measures of materiality that were used with respect to particular items or elements of financial statement disclosure. Again, there was also a high level of interest in knowing more about participation by other audit firms who were not the firm signing the opinion. And the only area in which there was relatively little interest compared to the other areas is on the question of disclosure of allocation of resources and hours spent on the various elements of the audit. So that, again, these are the threshold areas. We move on now to the discussion of the survey, portions of the survey which questioned our respondents on what more they would like to know about how the audit was conducted and what more they would like to see in terms of manner of disclosure of the findings and the results of the audit. And Gus and Ann will take you through those two areas.
And Gus, why don't you... Gus, for the record, hey Gus, why don't you say at the outset how much Vanguard has under management?